Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording from our 2024 Passover learning series with Rabbi Elliot Dorf.
The Passover story that we're used to is not just part of the Jewish tradition. It really is the central story of the Jewish tradition. And as such, if you look at it that way, it can be very productive to compare the Exodus Sinai trek to the Promised Land, to compare that story with stories of other communities. A former student of mine, Michael Goldberg, he was in rabbinical school in the 1970s. He finished rabbinical school at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and then he did a doctorate in narrative theology at Graduate Theological Union. And one of his books is Exodus Sinai and the Passion Resurrection, Jews and Christians Getting Their Story Straight. And what he does in that book is that he compares these two stories as to what these stories say about who we are as individuals and who we are as a community. And what does this mean in terms of how we should not only who we are, but who we should strive to be. So in other words, who is the model? What does the model Jew look like? And what does the model Christian look like? And you would expect that there are going to be some similarities. After all, we're all human beings, right? But the answer to the question but there are a lot of real differences. I'm just going to talk about those two for the moment, but we're going to spend most of our time today talking about two other stories, namely the Exodus Sinai story and the American secular story. But just to show you how this works in regard to the Jewish and the Christian stories, in the Christian story, I am an individual who was born with original sin. And as such, it's something that there's no salvation by works, Paul says in the New Testament. And so consequently, nothing I do can overcome my sinfulness. And the only way in which I can deal with my sinfulness is by belief in a supernatural intercessor, namely Jesus, right? If you look at the Jewish tradition, we are not born with original sin. We are born with, the way the rabbis put it, as a Yetzer HaTov and a Yetzer HaRa, a good inclination and a bad inclination. But even that has to be really defined, because the rabbis tell the story that at one point, all the righteous people in the world asked God to take away the evil inclination, and chickens did not lay eggs. People did not build houses. They did not get married and have children. No, those are good things. So the Yetzer HaRa, the evil inclination, is really the self-serving inclination. And the Yetzer HaTov is the altruistic inclination. And you need to have both. As a matter of fact, the rabbis tell the story of a man who had such a developed altruistic inclination that whenever he had money, he would give it away. And so on the day of his daughter's wedding, the court had to send delegates to accompany him to the wedding so that he wouldn't give away his daughter's dowry on the way to the wedding, right? There can be too much of altruism. And I actually know of a couple who divorced over the fact that he always was doing things for her, and she felt that she could never catch up, right? There really does need to be a kind of balance between the self-serving and the altruist inclination. The rabbis say, the self-serving inclination is alive and fully developed at the moment of birth. And all you have to do is look at infants. It's me, me, me. And, we actually have some good research that infants don't even realize that mommy and daddy are separate from themselves for about the first 2 months of life, right? So that, it takes 13 years, the rabbis say, to fully develop the altruistic inclination, hence Bar and Bat Mitzvah at age 13. And from that moment through the rest of life, through adulthood. It's a balancing act in which you have to balance your self-serving instinct and your altruistic instinct. But both of those are very much within your power. And therefore, it is very much your responsibility to do that, right? To be not just self-serving and not just altruistic, but to have a balance of those things, right? Now, that's a very different picture of the human being and the human being's abilities and responsibilities than you get in the Christian tradition, right? And you can see that in these central stories. You also get a very different, just to compare those two one more time, a very different understanding in terms of what this means in terms of accepting authority. For many years, I did a program called Bearing Witness for the Anti-Defamation League. It was a program with teachers in Catholic high schools, most of whom themselves were Catholic. And the priest with whom I did it would say to his fellow Catholics, "We Catholics are good at reception. We receive what we are told." At which point I tell them, "Jews are terrible at reception. We question everything." Right? And all you have to do is, you know, well, my wife, Marlon, many of you know her, for many years, taught in at seventh and eighth grade at Pressman. And twice a year, there would be a day when seventh and eighth graders at the Catholic school on Corning and Pico would come over. Well, they would come to Pressman one day, and the Pressman kids would go to the Catholic school the other day. And the way that Marlon describes it, is that just watching them come into the room is completely different, right? The Catholics would come in single file, quiet. The Jews would come in talking and all kinds of, with no organizational pattern whatsoever. And then when the conversation started, it would be really hard to get the Catholics to question anything, right? They would just sit there and accept what they were being told. Whereas the Jews were, you know, questioning everything, right? So, I mean, whether you should question authority is one another example of how these two cultures really, really are in conflict in terms of how you look at what the ideal teacher-student relationship is like, mm-hmm. or what the relationship to authority is like, right? The reason why I mention all of this is because Jews tend to think that the whole world is Jewish, or if not Jewish, then at least thinks the same way that Jews do. But it really isn't so. There are some similarities between the Christian tradition and the Jewish tradition, but there are also considerable differences. And I think that one needs to at least understand that. As a matter of fact, I have been on many Batei Din, many rabbinic courts for people who are converting to Judaism. And the two things that I hear sometimes the person has fallen in love with a Jew and wants to marry a Jew, and that's okay as long as they're in love with Judaism also at the time that they're converting. But the vast majority of the people who convert are not in that kind of romantic relationship. And when I ask them, well, what is it that attracts you to Judaism? Right. The two things that they mention most often are the ability to ask any question, which you don't get in a lot of other cultures. And we're a real outlier in that we take it for granted. But the Buddhists, the Hindus, the Confucian tradition, the Taoist tradition, Islam and Christianity do not accept that at all. And all of those traditions, you're supposed to simply accept what you are told. It's really only in the Jewish tradition that you answer a question with a question. And as one of my Talmud teachers said, very often in the Talmud, the question is better than the answer. We're used to that kind of thing, right? But that we're a real outlier in that. So that's one thing that converts very often say. And the other is they sense a very strong sense of family and community in our tradition, which presumably they have not. I mean, there are certainly Christian and Muslim families and communities. Don't get me wrong here. But we do have a very strong sense of being responsible for each other. Don't separate yourself from the community. Hillel says in Pirkei Avot, we are all responsible for each other. That kind of thing is just simply part of our DNA. But it's not really part of the DNA of a lot of other communities. So, I mean, in comparing the Christian and the Jewish community, the Jewish tradition on who we are and whatever is our relationship to our families and communities, what kind of a person should we strive to be? What kind of a community should we strive to create? It's not, I think it's important to understand that not everybody agrees with the way that Judaism responds to those questions. And as a matter of fact, most other cultures have very different answers to those questions. Now, this will then set us up for what I wanted to talk about tonight, which is the two cultures that are very close to us as American Jews, namely the American secular culture and the Jewish tradition. And as American Jews, we inherit both of those traditions, and we really hope that not only hope, but we expect that both of those traditions are one and the same, and they are all and they completely complement each other. And as a matter of fact, I remember I'm old, so some of you may remember the Silverman Prayer Book, the Sabbath Festival Prayer Book. It was published in 1946. It was the first conservative prayer book that was used almost throughout the conservative movement. And at the back of it, it had a reading, I think designed, intended primarily for Thanksgiving services, where there was a quote from the Bible or from rabbinic literature, and then another quote from American culture, which was supposedly said the same thing. And there were like 10 of these things. And my hometown rabbi, loved this reading. So we read it not just on Thanksgiving or the Shabbat before Thanksgiving. We read it a number of times during the year, because certainly for Jews in the 1950s, this was really important as part of our identity. That being a Jew was, if not the same as being an American, was certainly in consort with being an American. The two stood for the same sorts of values, the two traditions. Now, what I'm going to suggest to you is that in some ways that these two traditions that we have inherited do in fact reinforce each other, but in some important ways they do not, and they actually diverge. So let me start with the ways in which they reinforce each other. One way is that in both traditions, the individual is to be respected. That doesn't mean you have to like everybody, and it certainly doesn't mean you have to approve of what everybody does, right? But in each of these traditions, the individual is accorded respect and protection. In the American tradition, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What am I quoting, anybody? You can unmute yourself. What did I just quote?
Declaration of Independence.
You got it. The Declaration of Independence. Right. And Thomas Jefferson, cribbed that from John Locke, who had written that about a century earlier, except that Locke had said life, liberty, and property. And Jefferson changed that to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And you can imagine how many doctoral dissertations have been written about why the change, right? But the point is that in this kind of enlightenment theory, I am an individual with rights. Everybody is. And as such, has to be respected. To preserve the next line in the Declaration of Independence is to preserve these rights, governments are instituted among men. So the whole point of government is for the Declaration of Independence is to preserve rights. So we start out with each individual has rights in the American tradition. Now, notice that's not the case in a lot of other cultures. Certainly in communist countries, the community takes precedence over the individual. Even in socialist countries and on Israeli kibbutzim, the community takes precedence over the individual, right? So that I mean, you need to understand that this kind of individualism is very much a product of Enlightenment thought, which other nations in the West also have, including Israel, right? But in the United States, this kind of individualism is really taken far further than it is in most other Western cultures, to the point where, at least under certain circumstances, you can sue the government as an individual in America, whereas you cannot in most other Western cultures, even though they inherited this kind of individualism that comes out of the Enlightenment idea. So the reason why I need to be respected is because I am born with rights, and those rights need to be respected. In the Jewish tradition, the reason why I need to be respected is very different. It's because I was created in the image of God, and so is every other human being. So consequently, again, that doesn't mean that everybody is to be liked or everybody's behavior is to be condoned. But it does mean that you start out with that presumption. And the Torah even says that when somebody is convicted of a capital crime, this is Deuteronomy chapter 21, and is hanged, you have to take the body down before nightfall, because a hanged body is kelilat Elohimi. It is a curse of God. Why is it a curse of God? Because the individual, even one who committed a capital crime, was created in the image of God, and that has to be respected even if you carry out the ultimate punishment. Now, the rabbis didn't like capital punishment altogether, so they effectively got rid of it. But it's interesting to note that even the somebody who does the worst of the worst to warrant a capital conviction, warrant execution, nevertheless has to be respected even after being executed. So that's one thing which the American culture and our Jewish culture share, namely an inherent respect for the individual. And another thing which they share is a very strong trust in law, to the point where even the king has to write in the Torah, that according to Deuteronomy chapter 21, chapter 17, the king has to write a copy of the Torah for himself and have it next to him at all times, in order to indicate that even the king is subject to the law, right? And we'll see how far this goes in some of the cases that are coming up this summer. Even the president is subject to the law, at least I hope. But certainly that is the way that the law is set up, right? The sense that, whereas in dictatorships and in certain kinds of monarchies of the past, and in certain places now, Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, right, is not subject to anything, any law that binds him, right? So the American part of us and the Jewish part of us, share those two very important things. However, these two traditions that we inherit differ from each other in several important ways. One way is that in the American tradition, I am a person with rights, and whereas in the Jewish tradition, I'm a member of a community with duties. So let me start that off again. Right, in the American tradition, I'm an individual. In the Exodus Sinai story, we don't leave Egypt as individuals. We leave as a community. And when we get to Sinai, we don't get a single right. We get 613 commandments. So I do a lot of interfaith work. And when I'm talking to Catholics, I say to them, this is the beginning of Jewish guilt, right? 613 commandments. And they assure me that we know nothing about guilt. They have that cornered. I'll take their word for it. But the point is that it's we start out with presuming that I have duties. Now, in some ways, the rights and duties are reciprocal. So I have a right to my sweater, which means that you have a duty not to steal it, right? But rights and duties are not always reciprocal. my duties to my children are not the same as my duties to my parents. My duties to my country are not the same as my country's duties to me, right? So rights and duties are not always reciprocal. And in any case, if I get up in the morning and I am an individual with rights, then the world owes me. But if I get up in the morning and I am a member of a community with duties, then I owe the world. It's a whole different way of understanding who I am and how I should function in the world, right? It's a very different perspective as to how you understand the very core of your being and your relationship to the community. So there's another really important difference. It's very hard to be an American citizen if you were not born in this country, right? But once you are an American citizen, whether through birth or through immigration, as long as you have not committed a felony, you can go to any U.S. embassy or consulate outside the United States, fill out some pages of paper, and renounce your citizenship.
Oh, my God.
Let me repeat that again. Right? As long as you have not committed a felony, if you are an American citizen, you can go to any American embassy or consulate outside the United States, fill out some pages and renounce your citizenship. And some American citizens do that every year, primarily for tax reasons. Okay. But Americans do that. In the Jewish tradition, once you are a Jew, either by birth or by rebirth through the rites of conversion, you are a Jew for the rest of your life. So what happens if you convert to another religion? You're a Jew, but now you convert to another religion. Well, you lose all of the privileges of being Jewish, but you still have all the obligations. That really is Jewish guilt. But what it also is a very organic understanding of the nature of community, as opposed to a voluntary understanding of the nature of community that exists in Enlightenment countries like the United States. Right? In the United States, again, as long as I haven't committed a felony, I can decide to renounce my citizenship. But as a Jew, once I was born Jewish, or if I had been converted to Judaism, right, then I'm a Jew for the rest of my life in terms of my obligations. And it's sort of like your hands cannot decide to just leave you. It's simply part of you. It's an organic part of you. Well, in the same sort of a way, the way that the Jewish tradition understands our communal existence as a people is that we are organically connected to each other. And that's why you get the kinds of things I was mentioning before. Hillel, do not separate yourself from the community. All Yisrael, Arevim, Zebazeh, the Talmud says all Israelites are responsible for each other, right? Which we take very seriously in all kinds of ways. It also, I think, is part of the reason why, you know, when Jews do really well, we all get very proud, even though we had nothing to do with it. And when Jews do very poorly, then we feel really bad. Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years in prison today, right? And that hurts. I don't know him at all. I didn't invest in his company. I had nothing to do with it, right? But I feel really bad. Right. And that comes out of, and Bernie Madoff and et al. Right. So that sense of very strong connections to community is part of this, both for good and for bad, as part of these, this organic sense that we have. I mean, we all are very proud of all the Jews who have won Nobel Prizes, all the Jews who have had public office and now who have public office. Actually, when President Biden became president, I got an email from Feller, I think, that there was a minion in the White House or something like that. There are a number of cabinet officers who are Jewish, including Janet Yellen and Anthony Blinken and some others, right? I don't know if it's a minion, but still, I mean, you know, and one is rightfully proud of that. And, you know, all the people who have done really good things in public life and in science and medicine and so on, right? So there, it's a really very different kind of thing in terms of our sense of community is organic rather than individual. And our sense of, we start out with a sense of duty to the community rather than a sense of rights as against the community, right? As, which is the American tradition. Now, how do we, so those are just two examples of where the two traditions differ. Now, how do we, and by the way, there are a number of other places, if we were to take this further, there are a number of other places where the two traditions really differ. Think about, you know, what is, what are some of the ideals in American society? You know, who are the people that you see on the news all the time and that kind of thing, right? As opposed to what are the ideal kinds of what is the ideal woman, man, transgender person, whatever, right? What are the ideals that the Jewish tradition sets up for us? Again, much more communitarian in the Jewish tradition, as opposed to much more individualistic and self-serving in the American tradition. Again, that's not to say that there's not any of that in the American tradition. You can get a tax write-off if you give charity in the American tradition, but you have no legal obligation to give charity, right? On the other hand, in the Jewish tradition, first of all, the word charity comes from the Latin caritas, which means caring. You're an especially caring person if you give charity, right? On the other hand, the word for that in Hebrew is tzedakah, coming from tzedek, meaning it's justice. And you have a duty, starting all kinds of places in the Torah, where you have a duty to give to the poor, to take care of the orphan and the widow and the sick and so on. Okay? And the rabbis expand that even further. We Jews have an obligation to take care of the sick and the poor and the mourning among non-Jews, as well as among Jews, right? At least for the sake of peace with the non-Jewish communities. Right, the Talmud says that at a time when the Jews were living under the Romans, and I can guarantee you, the Romans were not worried about our sick and poor and mourning people. Right, so it's really rather remarkable that the tradition of caring for others as being an obligation on our part is really important. Another example of that is visiting the sick, which is a nice thing to do in America. But again, it's over and above what can really be expected of people. But in the Jewish tradition, it's a mitzvah. It's a commandment. Not just a mitzvah in the sense of a good deed. It's a commandment that you visit the sick. Right? Again, the sense of needing to go beyond yourself to take care of others. And that comes out of a very strong sense of community. So I'm going to say one more thing, and then I want to stop and take whatever reactions and questions you have. When we celebrate Passover, we're celebrating the central story of our tradition, Exodus, Sinai, the trek to the Promised Land. And at the Passover Seder, as I'm sure you have done for years, you, again this year, will unpack a number of the meanings of that story. And there are multiple meanings to that story. And one of the things that's really important is that we do that again each year because we're different every year than we were in the previous year. We've had different experiences. We may be with different people. I've been part of the priest rabbi law and dialogue, sponsored by the Los Angeles Archdiocese and the Board of Rabbis of Southern California since it began in 1973. So my kids grew up thinking that you could not have a Passover Seder without a priest present. But it's really interesting actually to see how they respond to all of this, right? And, for many years I taught a course in Jewish law at the law school at UCLA, and one of my students told me that he had invited a number of his Jewish and non-Jewish friends to the Passover Seder. And, at the end of the Seder, one of his non-Jewish friends said to him, "Now I understand why Jews are so good at the Socratic method. It's part of your religion," right? You know, this sense of questioning everything, right? And of being willing to challenge, you know, why do you say it that way, right? It's that kind of thing. I mean, I'll just give you one other story and then I really will stop. In 1996, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, which is about 70% of America's Lutherans, officially repudiated Luther's anti-Semitic comments. I mean, not a small thing, right? And then they created a Lutheran Commission on Theology, consisting of about 15 Lutheran theologians, to meet with six of us who do Jewish theology at Gustavus Adolphus College, which is a Lutheran college about an hour and a half southwest of the Minneapolis airport. And the way they were set up was going to be 3 days. The first morning, one of the six of us Jews would talk about a topic number one in the Jewish tradition. And then the rest of the morning, we would talk about that topic together, topic number two in the afternoon, and so on through 3 days. So the first morning, the presenter was Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, Rabbi Irving Greenberg, who is really smart, really learned, and a wonderful guy. Okay? He's a modern Orthodox rabbi. And he gave his presentation for about an hour on whatever the topic was. I don't remember. And of course, as soon as he finished, the other five of us said, well, it's not quite that way, right? Why did you interpret this source this way rather than that way? And what about this source that you didn't remember, right? That you didn't, you know. So then about an hour later, we looked up and these Lutheran theologians were absolutely bug-eyed. One of them said to me, he thought we were going to strangle each other at any moment, right? Because if you are Lutheran, especially if you're a Scandinavian Lutheran, you don't argue in public. Right? You stare, you glare, you get an ulcer, but you do not argue in public, right? And so what we had to learn from each other is the different ways in which our two traditions respect each other, right? In their tradition, the way you respect somebody is you just let them say whatever they want, right? In our tradition, you have to listen carefully and then ask follow-up questions and challenging questions and so on, because that's how you respect what somebody is saying. I listen carefully, which, by the way, comes out of a very deep sense of humility about what any human being can know, right? I mean, part of the reason, I think, why our tradition is so argumentative, just look at Abraham arguing with God, Moses arguing with God, Jeremiah arguing with God, Isaiah arguing with God, let alone Job and Kohelet, and that's only in the Bible. Then you get to the Talmud, which is one page of arguments after another, right? So where does that come from? I think it comes out of a very deep sense of the fact that no human being can know everything. God may be omniscient, but we're not. And so the only way in which human beings can actually come to any sense of truth and wisdom and goodness is by talking to each other and arguing with each other and trying to get trying to correct each other's mistakes and trying to get as far as we possibly can to what human beings can know. And even then we might make mistakes, right? So when we're doing the Seder this year, think about this as not an idea, oh, here we go again. Yes, it is here we go again in certain ways, but think of it as a new opportunity to investigate what this central story of our tradition means to us. And what I suggest to you is that, what I'm trying to suggest to you this evening is that when you do that, one way to do that, that I think might be very impactful is to compare it to other central stories of other cultures that you know. Today I was talking about Christianity and the American secular, the Enlightenment tradition. But you may want to compare it to any other culture you can think of, right? And that way, I think you will find that both the similarities of the Jewish tradition to other traditions and a lot of the differences. And I think that is really part of this central story that we call the Exodus from Egypt. Okay, let me stop here and take whatever questions you have, comments you have, whatever. Just, okay, yes. Table, raise your hand. Okay, go ahead.
I did, if it's okay. It's a
sure.
Different kind of question. So I'm not a young person, and my whole life, when in the Haggadah, we look at the four children, to me it was always, okay, the wise son, wise child, that's the best one. That's the one to aspire to. And I took two classes with Rabbi Rembaum that have just finished, and he kept talking about Ta'am, which I thought was simple, and he talked about it as perfect whole and all those things, and it has totally upended my sense of what Tom means and what to aspire to and wisdom versus simple and all those things, and I just would be interested if you think it's appropriate to have any reaction to the Tom and the meaning in the four sons and the four children in the Haggadah.
Well, I mean, I think it's, again, it's a text, and we Jews are very used to interpreting text in multiple different ways, right? So the fact that Rabbi Rambam upended your understanding of the four children in the Haggadah, I think, is very good. Okay, I think you did exactly what you should do, right? In order to awake us up to other possible meanings. There's a wonderful illustration of the four children. Let me see. Hold on just a moment. It's in the Rabbinical Assembly Haggadah. I think some of you may have that from a while ago. And let me get it for you. Yeah, here it is. Here, if you can see it. Can you see it? And basically what the illustrator is doing is saying that there's part of each of the four in each of the four. In other words, that, because if you look at, can you see this?
Yes.
So what the illustrator is doing is, you know, the colors are, if one color is the deep purple and one is orange and one is red and one is blue, there's orange and purple and red and blue in each one of the four children. And so the point of the illustrator here, the midrash, as it were, of the illustrator on that story is that nobody is purely any one of the four, right? That we all are partially each one of them in different contexts. Now, that's one interpretation of the four children, right? I think a rather interesting one. And the one that Rabbi Rambam was describing to you is yet another one. I had never thought of Tom in the way that you just described either, but that's fine. I mean, you know, it's a, which again, by the way, just to give you a sense of yet another difference between us, I told you I do a lot of interfaith work. So some of it is with evangelical Christians. And evangelical Christians are fundamentalists, right? They believe that the text has one meaning and one meaning only, and that the text is inerrant. It has no errors in it, right? So one time, this is years ago, I was on a Sunday morning on the treadmill, when my treadmill still existed before it died, on a Sunday morning, and I decided I was going to turn on one of these evangelical preachers at 10 in the morning on a Sunday. So it started out with some singing, which was lovely, and then the preacher got up and he opened the Bible, and he quoted a line, and he started banging the Bible. And then he talked about the meaning of that verse for about 10 minutes. And then he opened the Bible again and quoted the exact same verse and started banging the Bible. And then he gave the text a different meaning. He did that four times, right? So in the 40 minutes of his sermon, by the way, 40-minute sermon, don't complain when rabbis talk for a little while. Okay. In the 40 minutes of the sermon, he gave four different interpretations of that same verse. Now, from my perspective, that's just four different midrashim on the same verse, right? Texts are open to multiple interpretations. As a matter of fact, the rabbis say there are 70 faces to each text in the Torah. Right? That 70 is just a big number, but it means that every verse can be interpreted multiple ways. But I had no idea what he thought he was doing, right? Because as an evangelical preacher, he was committed to this kind of fundamentalist understanding of what the fact that the text has one and only one meaning, right? Now, I think they're in real trouble because texts are just not that way. The rabbis, I think, were much smarter in understanding that texts can have multiple meanings depending upon who's interpreting them, when, and what context, and the like, right? But that's another difference between our two traditions, right? And we start out with, as a matter of fact, Michael Fishbane, a professor of Bible at the University of Chicago, I think emeritus now, he wrote the Haftorah commentaries in Eitz Chaim, the Torah commentary that we read, that we use on Shabbat. He wrote a book in the mid 80s in which he pointed out that Midrash doesn't start with the rabbis, that the later strands of the Torah itself are interpreting earlier strands of the Torah, right? So that understanding of being able to interpret text in multiple ways begins even in the later strands of the Torah, and certainly all the more so by the time you get to the rabbis. So Rabbi Rema's understanding of the four children, the illustrator's understanding of it, your original understanding of it, all good. And be prepared for people to suggest others. Okay? Daniel. Sorry, Rabbi Brook. I'm sorry.
just to keep it really simple, I would think it's on the subject of discourse and all the ideas. What I'm most nervous about for this year's Seder is all the different opinions about the situation going on in Israel,
right?
That will be at the Seder table that I'm at. And I would really love to hear your thoughts and wisdom on that. You know, I thought a little bit of context. I was just staffing InterSEM, which is so lovely, with all the seminary students, just a few weeks ago. And I was worried that this would be a major topic of a major conflict area.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, because basically all the rabbinic students from AJR and HUC and seemingly from AJU, were in agreement of strong condemnation of the Israeli action, of the Israeli government's approach. But that was not, I wasn't, that was beyond the scope of that gathering to get into it with them. But I thought that was very telling. And in that context, I'd really love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think, you may want whoever is hosting the Seder, may want to send out a notice ahead of time. By the way, one thing, I'm going to answer your question, but this is reminding me to suggest things to you. This comes from Ron Wolfson years and years ago, who wrote a commentary on the Passover Seder, a really good commentary on the Passover Seder. He sees the Seder as actually four acts, as if it were in a play or in a concert, with similar themes in all four acts. But one of the things he suggested, he was the first one, I'm sure others have done it, but he was the first one that I read anyway, this goes back to the 1970s, is hand out parts to people long ahead of, before the Seder, and say, you know, this is the part of the Haggadah that you're responsible for. You can just read it, but if you can, tell us something that it sparks in you, right? So that people actually come prepared for the Seder with some thoughts. And it's, I think it's a way of deepening the discussion and also of getting people to actually, you know, understand that it's, you don't just show up, you come, you know, prepared for a serious discussion. But in whatever the host sends out, I think it would be important this year, especially because of what you're talking about, to say that if we are going to talk about Israel, please understand that the rules of the game are mutual respect. And that what it means is that, people can have very different views about what's going on there. Jews do, as do non-Jews, right? And it's a, and that consequently, if we're going to talk about it, it's got to be in a calm tone, and it has to be with mutual respect. And if we can't manage that, then I, the host, am going to cut off the conversation about Israel and just say that we have to talk about other things, right? In other words, if we can't manage it in a calm and respectful conversation, then it's going to be to everybody's benefit that I interrupt. And let me tell you ahead of time that I'm going to do that, right? So that when people come to the Seder, they know the rules of the game, right?
But isn't that to give push? And yes, of course, I agree. And isn't that kind of the opposite of what you were just saying about the Jewish approach, which I love, but we are not, but we're so struggling now as a community to still be able to have that passionate discourse and questioning without getting upset. Everyone now, as we do that, is getting, just gets upset, as opposed to actually being able to talk it through with that humility you were speaking of.
Yeah, but the difference, I think, is that it's one thing if you're talking about different meanings of a text. It's another thing here where you're talking about people's literally lives, right? I mean, because we are a very small people, 0.2% of the world's population, right? And roughly half of the Jewish population lives in Israel. So it's not at all unusual that Jews here have relatives there, right? Or friends there. And so it really has become not just an academic discussion, it is really a personal discussion. And personal discussions can be, there certainly can be disagreements. The fact, I have a lot of friends with whom I disagree, and that's fine. Friends can disagree and family members can disagree. But that can only really, you can only preserve the relationship if you start off from the very beginning with ground rules about how this conversation is going to take place, especially because a lot of us are very emotionally involved. And frankly, in terms of this network of our families that I was talking about, a lot of us are literally physically involved as well. So if there's going to be a conversation at the Seder table about Israel, it's going to be under the following rules of the game. That's what I would suggest anyway. Good. Diane, I think you were next.
So kind of in the same vein, but maybe a little differently. I'm wondering if we're obviously living through a very difficult time in Jewish history, maybe even monumental in Jewish history, both with what's going on in Israel and also the anti-Semitism in this country. Right. And I'm wondering what we should bring to the Seder table. How should those things impact our Seder? It's hard to conceive of having a Seder this year that's about the history as opposed to what's actually happening. And I'm wondering what we should bring in to make it more, relevant to our time.
Well, the story itself is about redemption from slavery. You know, the Egyptians didn't treat us very well. Talk about anti-Semitism. The Seder includes Shvoch hamatcha al hagoyim asher lo yida'ucha, pour out your wrath on the nations who did not know you. Right? It includes that. So I don't know, just on the basis of the kind of evening I want to have, you know, the Seder, I don't know that I would spend a lot of time on it, because Jews are certainly aware of it all. But I think it is appropriate to point out that our experience of anti-Semitism is not new to us. It has been around since at least Egypt, you know, in the Egypt of the Bible, of the biblical period. And it's in the Seder itself, in that prayer about, you know, pouring out your anger on the nations who did not know you. Right. So, I mean, which is a medieval prayer. Right. So often we would just say it and move on. But this year, because of the rise of anti-Semitism, maybe you can just go around the table and say how people respond to it. Do you want God to pour out his anger on the people who don't know you? Or do you want to try to create new kinds of relationships? Or do you think that's futile? Right? I mean, you can have a conversation around that prayer or around the slavery pieces altogether. Right? And I wouldn't shy away from it. I think you're right. I think it's, in Passover today is very different from last year and all years previous. Not that there wasn't anti-Semitism there, but it's just much more rampant and much more open this year than it has been in the past in this country, let alone elsewhere. I think if you're planning the Seder, then you may want, again, you may want to warn people ahead of time that when we come to talking about slavery, or when we come to talking about that prayer, I will be asking people to reflect on their response to anti-Semitism. I think it would be worthwhile warning people ahead of time, both about Israel conversations and about anti-Semitism, because people's feelings are really raw about those for very good reason, right? But I think if they come prepared for that conversation, you can have it. And again, I would be very careful not to, at least I would say, this is after all a holiday. I don't want it to be a downer about either Israel or the anti-Semitism, right? We're saying Hallel as part of the Seder, right? But I mean, that doesn't mean we should live in a kind of Pollyannish world. You can really talk about the realities, but make it a part of the Seder and not the whole of it.
Pour out your wrath. That part is particularly difficult to do if you have non-Jews at your Seder, no?
It's really difficult to do if you have
non-Jews sitting at your Seder table.
Yes, it is much more difficult. And in which case, maybe you won't talk about it there. Or maybe you will. Maybe you can ask them, what they think about. What should we do? By the way, I mean, I told you that I do a lot of interfaith work. One of the things I'm involved in is the Academy for Jewish, Christian, and Islamic Studies. And I've been involved with that since the 1980s. And so I know a number of Muslims. And one of them called me on October 9th and said to me, what happened on October 7th is not Islam, right? It's a perversion of Islam. And this is a guy who is a radiologist, has an MD and two PhDs. I mean, a really smart guy. And he called me on October 9th to tell me that. And that doesn't mean all Muslims think that, right? But I mean, you may, if you're going to have non-Jews at the Seder, you can ask them what they think we should do, right? Good. Rebecca, I think you were next.
Yeah, I don't really have a question. I have more of a comment.
Sure.
What you had said about that, the comparison, I guess, between the sense of duty and maybe simplistically saying sense of entitlement, those two forces, it really resonated with the podcast that I'm listening to right now from Israel, a Micha Goodman podcast. Mm-hmm. That discusses the politics, and it discussed in a lot of detail how those two forces are playing now or prior to October 7th in Israeli politics. And post October 7th, the discussion really went in a direction to what does Israel need in order to survive? Which part of these two? And obviously the opinion they reach is that you need both, really. Yeah. Duty, the sense of duty, and you need the sense of some entitlement and human rights and so on. But it really resonated how those two forces were discussed both in terms of Israeli politics prior and now in terms of just surviving in the Middle East.
Right. And in Israel, it often is articulated as Israel is a Jewish and democratic country. So how does the Jewish part and the democratic part, how do they interact with each other? Right. And that's been part of the DNA of Israel since the Declaration of Independence in 1948. Right. And it's a very, it's a very delicate balance. And I must say, the precedents of other kind of Christian countries who have tried to be both Christian and democratic are very mixed. I mean, if you think about Catholic countries like Ireland and France and Poland, right? Or think about Protestant countries, Switzerland, or part of Germany anyway, right? And part of France actually also. They really have not, well, France ultimately has gone to complete secularization, laissez-faire, right? Germany goes in the opposite direction. The government actually funds religious communities, right? And what happens in the United States in terms of, you know, separation of church and state? And you can see the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1960s was really, the Warren Court was really making the separation between church and state a real wall of separation, right? The current Supreme Court is making that much thinner, right? So even in the United States, and the question of, you know, Christian nationalism, right, is this supposed to be a Christian country? Which I thought a long time ago was settled, and the answer was no, but it's not so clear anymore, right? So I mean, it's the attempt to try to integrate a religious tradition with a Western philosophical liberalism, right? Every community that I just mentioned is having difficulty with that.
Right.
And you can understand why, because they go in different directions.
Right.
Right.
The sense of duty doesn't mesh well with the sense of, you know,
right,
human rights. And
that's right. Now, that said, I do want to reiterate the places where they overlap, right? A sense that each individual is to be respected, which again is not what happens in a lot of other countries, right? And a sense that law has to govern everybody, right? Again, which is not obvious in all kinds of other countries. So those are two really important places. There's some others as well, but those are two really important places where the two cultures overlap. By the way, another one is pragmatism, right? A real sense that, that we need to make this a better world in some way. And that includes innovations of all sorts, right? And the role of science in culture, right? And medicine, right? All of that. It's 8:30. I'm supposed to stop now, but if anybody has any other questions, I'll be happy to take them.
May I have a quick one, just a comment?
Sure.
Which is from Noam Saxion's A Different Night. I just made it my virtual background. I have it from the first year of the pandemic. It's pour out thy, oh no, I can't read it. In addition to pour out thy, it's pour out thy love on our allies, the righteous Gentiles, page 142. If people have a different night.
Okay, good. Noam Saxion was a camper of mine at Camperman, Wisconsin, a long time ago. I am old. Okay. All right. I think let's call it a night and have a wonderful Chag Kasher v'Sameach and have a really meaningful Seder. I hope you really do.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcasts site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am, Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.